The following is a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio with Dr. Alex Hubline and Dr. Josh Claypo. This is Adapt or Perish.
Welcome to Adapt or Perish. I'm Dr. Josh Claypo along with Dr. Alex Hubline, president of Adaptagent. Alex, how are you?
I'm good, man. How are you?
I am good. You know, every time before a show, I ask you, send me your thoughts. And this one read, your thoughts as of last night. Now, you know I'm a psychologist. So your thoughts last night read more like a poetic novel, more than a business strategist. Like, I read through it and I had this like warm, fuzzy feeling like I was sitting by the fire reading a novel, but I also couldn't figure out any questions to start off with. Because it was some deep shit, man. I just don't even know how to say it other than that. So your title that you wanted to talk about today, I love this, was A Crystal Ball or Just Better Eyeglasses. And so I started thinking, you know, we're all in this, and I've had this with my clients the last few days. We're all in this kind of strange, foggy, discombobulated reality, you know, where we think we know where we're going, and then all of a sudden something hits us when we take a different turn. And the question that came to me was, how do we see the future? You know, we talk about visionaries and being able to see the future and see where things are going. But frankly, and just to use a little bit of a pun, is there really a path to the future given what was going on right now? Or Alex, is it all just a grand illusion?
I love the reference there. See, we're working sticks into all these shows, so I think we're gonna have to spread out and share the love here with some other bands, man.
It felt like the easiest one, and it just came to me. So anyway, with that, and I do think it is true. I mean, I can't tell you how many clients I've talked to in the last week where, you know, they're navigating their present. And they're trying to adapt or perish so that they don't perish. But this idea of being able to see the future right now, like, how the hell do you do that?
Yeah, it's tough, right? And I think the grand illusion reference is really good here because, you know, when you look at it, I mean, a lot of people talk about visionaries, right? You'll talk about visionaries in the music world or in the artistic world or in the business world. You know, we talk about people like Steve Jobs and we talk about people like Mark Zuckerberg and whoever, right? All these supposed visionaries. And I think some of them were. Some of these people have gone out and they've been able to pretty accurately predict the future and really create the future. You know, when I worked for HP for a long time, and we had a saying at HP that, you know, the best way to predict the future is to invent it. And I loved that, right? That was one of those really feel good taglines, like, yeah, man, let's go out and, you know, but here's the reality, I think. And that is that, you know, that as romantic an idea as that may be, I think it's probably the exception rather than the rule. I mean, I think there are a lot of people out there that are visionaries and, you know, they've done some amazing things, but let's face it. I mean, 99.9 something percent of us aren't, you know, we're not these grand visionaries who are going to change the world. Right. And so, you know, you can try to study what visionaries did and what they do and some of the techniques, but, you know, I'm not sure that's really the best course of action. I think that, you know, when you really come down to it, I think a lot of it is just about perception. And I mm-hmm. think that, you know, being able to kind of see what's right in front of us is a skill that is often overlooked. And I think that's probably the best most of us are going to be able to do, right? So, you know, you read all these books about visionaries and you think, well, I'm going to be just like those guys. And you know what? You probably let's not inflate our own egos too much, right? And then I think, you know, you also run into this challenge that, you know, sometimes these quote unquote visionaries or luminaries, they just got lucky.
I was going to ask you that. I mean, because everybody kind of knows. Well, I don't know if everyone knows that, but it's what you just said. You always, whenever you read the book or ever you watch the movies or ever, you know, you hear about it, it's always they failed a million times and then something happened and they had a good idea or maybe even a great idea. And it was timing. You know, they always talk about timing. And I don't know if timing, how much timing is skill and luck. What are your thoughts on that one?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's maybe a bit of both, right? I mean, I think the one common thread you see in really successful people, the people that have gone out there and tried a bunch of things and failed at 90% of them, is that they're persistent. They just don't give up. And, you know, it's almost like rolling a set of dice. You know, you can't predict the outcome of those dice, but if you roll them enough times, you'll get that outcome, right? I mean, statistically, yeah, you're going to get that outcome, right? So I think that, you know, sometimes we call people visionaries, and in reality, they just got lucky. It's just like, you know, stock investors. You know, you'll see some of these investors who will tell you that, you know, buy into my portfolio because I've beaten the S&P 500 by 22% over the last 5 years or whatever, right? And you know, the thing that strikes you about those guys is that, look, if you took a random distribution of investment portfolios, some small percentage of them would beat the S&P 500, you know, up and down over any given period of time, right? That's just statistics. So I think, you know, you have to be careful in life I think we have to be careful not to look at those people as people that had a crystal ball necessarily, and people that just, you know, tried a lot of things and sometimes they got lucky. I think a lot of it is just persistence and talent. But at the end of the day, you know, I don't think that's something you can count on in whatever endeavor that you're going out and doing in life. Just look, statistically, you're probably not a visionary, okay? And I think we all have to accept that, right? And I think one of the hallmarks of the true visionaries is, you know, can they do it repeatedly, right? Yep. Can you go disrupt an industry or have a vision over and over again? And if that's the case, okay, yeah, you got to say, all right, that guy or that person was just a straight up visionary. But let's face it, most of us aren't. So the question I think becomes is, you know, how do the rest of us drive forward? You know, how do we make progress? How do we go out and innovate without necessarily being these almost legendary visionaries, right? And I think that comes down to perception. It comes down to being able to perceive our environment, perceive what's around us, and perceive it in the right way so that we can take advantage of things that are happening out in the market that are probably going to happen. I think that's probably the best most of us can do, but I think that's still pretty powerful because I would argue that's where a lot of the big breakthroughs come from as well, is sort of this incremental progress towards something. You know, it's not just about the big bang type of idea.
Can we get caught up though in ourselves? You know, you think about it, we sit back, a lot of us, and we're like, oh, I have a great idea, you know, and then it starts with a great idea and most of them never go anywhere, but depending on the idea, the people around you, the amount of money maybe you have, or we've talked about this in other shows, the amount of money you have access to, your great idea, whether it's great or not, can start moving forward if you've got sort of enough stuff behind it. But is it easy? I'm going to say this, I kind of have my own answer, but I'm going to throw it to you because I want to hear what you think. Is it easy, essentially, and I'm sorry for doing this, is to sort of create your own grand illusion, right? I've got this great idea, or I think the company should go here. And maybe you've done your due diligence, et cetera, but you're so bought into what is maybe an illusion relative to the market or relative to the immediate future that you get off track. You know, and again, yeah. I think about Adaptogen, and I am sure y'all have walked into situations where, you know, a company is decided to make a huge pivot, or they think they need to make a pivot, or they're going to go, and you know, they want your services, they want to do all this, and you're kind of looking at them going, you know, yes, we can help you, but I mean, how often do you see that?
Oh yeah, no, look, we see it all the time. And you know, we kind of specialize in, you know, helping organizations, you know, modernize some of the mission critical legacy software and computer systems that they've had for many, many years. And I can't tell you the number of times we've gone in and talked to people and, you know, they have this big grand illusion that we're going to take all this old stuff, we're going to rewrite it, we're going to put it in the cloud, and it's going to be this lovely shining future. Right. And in a lot of cases, that is this big grand illusion, because they get into it and they realize, wow, there's a reason this stuff still runs on this older software, because it's really complicated. And, you know, they go out there, they try to do it, and they just fail miserably. And, you know, some of them succeed for sure, but a lot of them, probably the bulk of them, end up in a situation where they have to go back and rethink their plan and make a pivot, where they come up with a hybrid strategy or whatever. So yeah, we see it all the time. And you have to be careful not to get into a situation where you're deluding yourself, where your vision of the future is the only vision of the future. Because if you do that, you know, it's very hard to let go of those things. And I think it's hard for big companies. And I think it's also hard for small companies though, right? I mean, if you're a founder of a company or you're running a small company, it's really difficult to come to grips with the idea that you might have to pivot from your original conception of what you wanted to do and what you wanted the company to become and take a different path and a different direction. That's really hard for people to do because, you know, you're almost admitting, hey, you know what, maybe I was wrong. And nobody likes to think that they're wrong.
That's so important. I mean, it gets down. It's a core human being thing. This idea that a willingness to hear either people or feedback, you know, a feedback, it may be feedback from investors, it may be feedback from the market, maybe feedback from a consultant that, you know, it's the idea that it's nothing against you personally, but this idea is not going to fly. And you're right, when you're that invested, either psychologically or that invested psychologically and maybe financially. So let me ask you this, is that the telltale sign of a great visionary? Because you said in the beginning, you know, the great visionaries, you know, they're persistent and they keep at it. Where's that line between being persistent and sort of being, you know, a dog on a bone and not looking at what's right in front of you, or maybe you're looking 20 feet ahead and being willing to look what's right in front of you? Where is that line, and how do you see that in the business that in the people that you interact with?
Yeah, well, I don't think it's so much of a line as it is a really, really murky gray area that everybody gets into. And that's what makes it so hard to figure out, right? But I think there's really two things that I found have been helpful to me in my career when I'm trying to figure out maybe three things. One is, you know, don't get too invested in this idea that you're a visionary, right? Smart people always like to think that they're smarter than everybody else and that, you know, their ideas are going to work out. So you can't get too invested in that, right? You've got to be able to take a step back and say, you know what, maybe I'm in the 99.99%. I'm still really smart, but maybe I'm not the Steve Jobs or the next whatever. So I think there's just that sort of implicit, recognition that, hey, you know what, I could be wrong here. So I think that's one area to it that you've really got to focus on is always be willing to consider the idea that you're completely wrong. And I think that done in a healthy dose is really good. Now, if you think that all the time, then you're going to have all kinds of self-confidence problems and you're probably not going to go anywhere.
Right, exactly.
But if you can kind of get past the ego, you can kind of get past that and say, you know, I could be completely wrong about this. We're going to give it a shot. And maybe we are wrong, but you know, it's okay to be wrong. As long as you learn from that, and as long as you're able to come up with alternative ideas, then, you know, there are plenty of people have been wrong about their initial ideas on things. So I think that's one technique. The second technique is being able to recognize situations where you're sort of becoming myopic, where mm-hmm. you're really going out there and being able to take a step back and say, wait a minute, am I thinking inside the box too much? Am I not thinking broadly enough here? Or am I so focused like a dog on a bone? Am I so focused on this that maybe I can't perceive what's really happening out in the world? And I think we talked about this in a past episode. There was a great book written. It's probably 20 years ago. It was called Why Smart Executives Fail. Mm-hmm. And fascinating book. But the conclusion of the book, I'll spoil it for everyone, is that, you know, you don't get to be the CEO of a Fortune 500 company by being an idiot, right? Every single one of those people is really, really, really smart. But the reason that a lot of times they fail is because their perception of reality is different than reality. Right. Mm-hmm. So being able to go out there and recognize that A, I could be wrong, and B, when you're in a situation where maybe you are misperceiving the world, to go in and get some different data sources on things, go get some different perspectives. And I think that kind of leads us into the third piece of it, which is you know, in order to be able to see things broadly and get a wide variety of perspectives, particularly in a company, but I think this is true in a band or any kind of organization, is that, you know, you've got to have a culture that not only accepts people coming up with ideas and presenting those ideas and disagreeing with people, but you've also got to come up with a culture that rewards it as well. You know, I spoke about HP earlier. You know, I also worked for many years for Red Hat Software, and just a wonderful company. And, you know, we spent a lot of time in the company, and the leadership invested a lot of time and money in developing this culture of openness and honesty and transparency, where, you know, the most junior person could stand up in a meeting with a bunch of executives and say, I think this idea is crap.
Oh, that's a unique experience, right? I mean, unique, because that I'm sorry to interrupt. I mean, I hear that all day long, that's the culture going after until it actually happens, right? And it's not even in business. Yeah. We hear it in academics. We hear it in any sort of setting where there's a differential in power. That's amazing. So you really experienced that? I mean, you sort of authentically...
Yeah, and people weren't afraid to stand up, and they weren't afraid to say, look, I don't think this is right. And as long as, you know, they had a good reason for it, they could back up their argument, people listened to them, and people didn't look down on them. They didn't look down on the people, because that person's just an intern. What could they possibly know?
Right.
And at the company, it was called a meritocracy of ideas, where the best ideas are the ones that should bubble to the top. It doesn't matter where they come from. It doesn't matter who brings up the idea. But as a culture, you kind of have to look at those ideas and try to objectively evaluate them the best you can. And it shouldn't really matter who brought the idea to the table and what their background was or whatever. You should analyze ideas and interpret ideas on their own merits, rather than just you saying them. So I think developing that corporate culture gives you the ability to expand your vision, because now it's not just you doing the perceiving of things, it is the whole company. And the whole company, you know, can see far more broadly and far more deeply than any one individual or a small leadership team. And I'll give you a really good example of this. So at Adaptigent, we've been trying to come up with some better pricing models for our customers. And we've gone round and round on it. And I was really, really focused on coming up with a pricing model that was really simple. It was really easy to quote, that our partners could go out and quote and understand. It had to be really deterministic. And so I said in my mind, I want a pricing model that achieves all of these things. And I just struggled with it for months and months. I sat there and I was trying to come up with like this grand unified theory of pricing. And you know, somebody pulled me aside at one point and said, why does it just have to be one model? Why can't we let customers have two or three choices on their pricing, and they can pick the best one that works for them? We still make money. They still get a lot of business value out of it. And you know, I felt like an idiot. I was like, I got so focused on this, having this one cool model, that it hadn't occurred to me that, hey, maybe there are multiple models we could come up with. And that was a big turning point for me. You know, that was a situation where you do the face palm and you're like, wow, why didn't I think of that? But, you know, if we hadn't built a culture where that's acceptable for anybody to come up and say, hey, you know, dummy, why don't you think about it this way? Then I'd probably still be sitting here, you know, scratching my head on my whiteboard trying to work this whole thing out, and I probably wouldn't have ever done it. So that's just a real concrete example of where, you know, building the right kind of culture can help a company broaden its vision, see different alternatives, and then be able to take those alternatives forward. And I think that's really what it's all about.
Do you think that with too many resources, that is harder or easier? Because I've seen the argument on both sides, right? So I've seen the argument of, we're a small, scrappy company, or smaller, scrappy company. We've got to figure things out, right? We've got to be willing to fail. We've got to be willing to, everyone's idea is good, because we got to get, you know, got to get to this place. There's only 10 of us or whatever. But the reality is, sometimes you're then working out of a semi-survival mode, right? We think it's creativity. We think it's visionary. We're going to do something different. We talked about this before. We're going to disrupt the market. But maybe you're actually just trying to make it. And then you take the flip side, and let's say you got lots of resources, you know, you're well backed, lots of VC money, or you're a big company, and you go, okay, well, we're in a position we can have the innovation unit, right, or the innovation division, and we can think about anything. But in that case, then do you get yourself in a problem where, you know, there's too many people, too many resources, too much bureaucracy? I mean, does it work in both situations, or is there a better scenario for creating not a visionary person, but a visionary company?
Well, yeah, look, I mean, I think it can work in both scenarios. I think it's easier the smaller you get. I think the level of difficulty is sort of roughly correlated with size and bureaucracy and all that stuff. But I think it comes down to leadership. And I think it comes down to even larger companies making sure that they still realize that they're struggling to survive, because everyone is, right? I mean, any company could go out of business within 5 years. I don't care what company you're talking about out there. A competitor could come along, a new technology could come along and wipe them out. But, you know, but I think, you know, going back to the music world, I think it's like this with bands too.
I know. It feels this way. This is why I was hoping you'd get into this. It's good. Go.
Yeah, I mean, like some of the best music that I think many bands have produced was in their early years, when they were just struggling to get recording time at a studio. They were schlepping their stuff all over the place. That, you know, they were doing gigs and they didn't have roadies or anything else. I think some of the best music actually came out of those almost quote unquote survival days, where, you know, they weren't making a lot of money. And as they became famous and they got more resources and they could kind of do whatever they want to, I think in a lot of cases, the music wasn't as good. It wasn't, it may have been more popular, but if you really sit down and listen to it critically, you find that a lot of those bands actually went backwards in terms of the quality of the music they were producing and the innovativeness of the music they were producing. They were kind of just, a lot of them were just kind of doing the same thing over and over. They found what success looked like commercially, and then they just kept doing it. And you're like, whoa, where did the creative spark go? Ooh. Where are those weird B-side songs that I love on?
Yeah,
on
but stop. But you're a music connoisseur and you don't have to make a living off of it. Like, that's really interesting. Think about it. You know, if we wanted, it's that classic, I wish I didn't have to make a living from whatever it is that I'm doing, because it's taking me in a different direction. I mean, it's almost as if what you just said, you know, the B-side stuff that we look at and go, oh, it's beautiful. Nobody bought that stuff, or they only bought it because they bought the A-side.
Yeah, exactly. Right?
So how do you do that in business? You know, I'm thinking of the founders who are so passionate about an idea, about how the market should be or how the world should be. And maybe they're right, but maybe the world is not ready for them, or frankly doesn't like them, or like not them personally, but like what they have. They can't keep pushing it, right? I mean, how do you find that balance? Because in music, it's a great example. We look at back on all of, you know, our favorite bands. We go, oh, look at those B-sides. Tony Curry Radio. We don't just play the B-sides on Tony Curry Radio, right? We play the upbeat, you play the upbeat music that's not overplayed. And I know Tony is very selective about kind of how he gets there, but he's definitely not just playing the old B-sides. He's definitely playing the stuff that people want to hear. How do you balance that in business?
Well, I think you hit it on the head, right? It's a balance. And I think that a lot of companies struggle to achieve that balance. You know, they struggle to achieve this balance between, you know, going out there and doing what they know they have to do to be successful and what's making them successful, but also allocating some time and resources to go out and explore some stuff that will be the next big thing, potentially, that will be the next commercial success for them, potentially. And most of that exploration is going to result in failure. Right. I mean, it's just going to, people are going to have a bunch of crazy ideas, and most of them candidly are probably crazy, but you don't need 1,000 good ideas. And I think that's one thing that a lot of companies really lose sight of, is that I don't need 1,000 good ideas. I just need a couple. Right. And then I can go out and take those couple of really, really good ideas, sort of the diamonds in the rough. And take those forward, and that can become my next big product or next big idea for the market. And so you still have to sort through a lot of the rubble to get to the diamonds. And so that's a hard process. And it's a process that I think a lot of companies get so focused on, well, we've already got the diamond mine over here. We're not going to go look for another one. We're not going to go through that pain of exploration and everything else. And if you don't do that, I think you eventually do perish. And we've seen that happen with company after company over the last 50 to 100 years. I mean, a lot of these companies have gone out of business because they were so focused on the cash cow or the big money maker right now, that not only did they not explore other things, but in a lot of times they discouraged it because they didn't want to end up competing with themselves. And you go, well, if you're not competing with yourself at times, somebody's going to figure it out, right? Someone's going to come compete with you and potentially drive you out of business. So I think it has to be a balance, right? Between, and it's what academics called exploitation versus exploration, right? Yes. Exploitation is, how do I milk the cash cow, right? It's not a not necessarily a bad word. It's just, how do I exploit the great things that I've done here that are making me a lot of money, while at the same time exploring new ideas, which, by the way, may be contradictory or competitive with my exploitation exercises. How do I go out and do that and strike the right balance between those two things, so that not only am I making money and profit in the current state of affairs and in the near future, but also in the long run? And I think that is the hallmark of companies that last and that grow and that achieve a lot of things, is that they're not just content to exploit what they have. They're always out there exploring.
Would you say that it is absolutely necessary for a company and the leadership of that company to put themselves in vulnerable situations? I mean, not risky where you're risking the company, but everything we've talked about is, you know, new ideas that may fail, listening to feedback, whether it's from feedback from within the company, from investors, et cetera, being persistent, but not, you know, but not so stubborn that you miss the boat. Are great visionaries and visionary companies willing to put themselves in vulnerable, either personal, psychological vulnerable, cultural vulnerable situations, where, again, where they are sitting there in that difficult place about, we may not be right, we may not succeed? Is that a key to being a visionary company?
I mean, I think it's what almost defines a lot of progress in within companies. I mean, I think you have to be, because, again, you know, capitalism has a lot of great things and some negative things along with it as well. But, you know, the thing you always have to remember is that if you're not willing to do that, put yourself into that vulnerable position, somebody else will. Right. And you'd rather be doing that to yourself than having some upstart competitor do that to you and put you in a vulnerable position. So I think it's all about recognizing the fact that you don't know everything, that, look, you know, yeah, you may have been successful in the past, but that's no guarantee of future success. And you've always got to be looking at that and putting yourself into some vulnerable situations, because if you don't, I guarantee you a competitor will come along and they'll put you in that position pretty much against your will. And then you're just reacting at that point. You're not going out and adapting, really. You're just purely reacting to a threat. And that's that, you know, nobody wants to be in a position like that.
You know, I knew a CEO once that I worked with who would always say, there's plenty of space, or there's plenty of space for lots of players in this field, in this area. It's a, you know, it's a big market that doesn't, and he would say, we don't have to be the number one. There's plenty of room for us to be in here. And I think about, you know, you and I often talk about bands that are sort of iconic bands, right? They are, I don't know if they're number one, but they're the ones that everybody knows. But if we lump them together, I was just thinking about this, but if we lump them together and you put together the Styx and the Bostons and the, Zeppelin and Zeppelin's pretty iconic, but you know, you sort of lump the classic rocks together. Is it okay to say there's room for us to be great, and we don't have to be the ultimate best as our goal? You know what I mean? That we want to be successful, and that in turn that may make us actually visionary company, rather than trying to, you know, be the top, the best only. Because if you look at music, you know, there's lots of hit bands. There's a gazillion classical. I mean, is that a good model for us?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think it is. I mean, I think you always want to strive to be the best. But it kind of comes down to what your definition of best is when you really think about it. And you're right. There are markets where there's room for lots of competitors. And it's okay to be in that market. Because look, at the end of the day, again, just statistically, the chances of you being number one in an industry with 1,000 players is pretty small, right? So you know, almost by definition, you're probably not going to be the number one player. I think it's always great to try to strive for that. But I think the recognition that, you know, I don't have to have the majority of the market share or whatever. I can make a really innovative, really strong business that goes out and espouses and lives the right kind of principles. I can do it right without just, you know, always having to be number one. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's being realistic about things.
So really what you're saying then is it can be a grand illusion. And it can be a grand illusion that we actually live, that it's not a farce, and that what we see is our own personal grand illusion.
I think so. What do you think? I think so.
Okay. We're out of time. We're out of time. But catch us again, because you know we're going to come with another great topic, another mashup of classic rock and business strategy. Join us, as always, on Tony Curry Radio for another episode of Adapt or Perish.
This has been a special presentation of Tony Curry Radio.